Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Christian Contrarian. I'm Gary Wayne, author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, and this is Episode 12, Satan Part 2, that I've entitled The Melchizedek Resolution. In the previous episode, Episode 11, we talked in detail about who Satan was in terms of his position and his position in the hierarchy as an archangel and as a cherubim and as a seraphim. And we're going to add to that title today as we dig deeper into the details of just who this individual was and how big of an influence he had right through Genesis, right through to Revelation. The thing is, though, when we talk about that sort of influence that he has from the beginning and the end in Genesis, we don't find that we get the name of Satan in the Eden account, nor do we get Satan in Genesis. In fact, we don't see Satan's names as mentioned until we get into 2 Chronicles 2 and Job 1 and Job 2. And so we have to almost sort of infer that Satan was involved in the Eden account and everything that happened in the Genesis account before the flood. Because again, his name just isn't mentioned. So when we look at Satan as influencing this account in Eden that we're talking about, I would underscore that with that the serpent there goes back to the word Nakash. And Nakash is a beast of the field and is working with Satan to deceive Eden. And we know this because Satan isn't the one who is punished after the fall of Eve and Adam. It's the Nakash. Satan doesn't have his arms taken off, and Satan doesn't have his legs taken off. He doesn't have his wings taken off. He doesn't have his voice taken away. He doesn't have his intelligence taken away. He isn't forced to crawl on the ground as a species of animals, even though the Nakash are held responsible in conspiring with Satan. None of these things happen to Satan. So it's the Nakash that does the actual physical deed here. And so we need to understand that as we look at what happens in Eden and the influence Satan has as sort of this master puppet master, both in prehistory, in history, and into the end time. And we know Satan is going to be having a significant part of the end time because he's talked about in Revelations, and particularly right through Revelation 12, where he and his angels are sent down to the earth, and then he is sentenced to the abyss at the end of Armageddon, and then to the lake of fire after the millennium. So Satan has a significant influence on humankind. And so we have to infer his way, though, into the Eden account. And so when we look at how we do that and how we think that he's involved on that, first of all, I'll use some New Testament references in 1 John 3, where it talks about Cain as being of the wicked one. And the wicked one is following Satan and leading Cain and Cain's progeny and followers away from God and to follow the fallen angels that helped bring the whole antediluvian epoch into the first apocalypse by water, with all of the things that Cain did with partnering with Satan, the fallen angels, creating the Nephilim, and all the violence and corruption of the antediluvian world. And this is what is known as the way of Cain that's talked about in Jude 1. So again, we get this inference to Satan in the Eden account, but we still don't have a direct frame or reference to put Satan there as part of the conspiracy to deceive the Nakash, to deceive Eve. And so we get that, though, in Ezekiel 28, where it talks about the anointed cherub who walked amongst the fiery stones that we talked about in episode 11. And so in Ezekiel 28:13, we clearly get a description of Satan being in Eden, as it says so. And so this infers again that this would be by how we understand the references to Eden in the Bible, that would be the time of Adam and Eve. But he's not the one who causes the fall directly. Again, he's the puppet master. And in this case, I think he actually avatars the Nakash. And this isn't a possession because he's an angelic being, but I think he has a symbiotic relationship, as avatar means, with the Nakash, who needs that extra help and the intelligence and the skill level to deceive Eve. And again, it's the Nakash who is punished, and I think that's because he invites Satan in order to pull this scheme off. And if that's not the case, then I think he's coached, the Nakash is coached from the sidelines by Satan. And we get this sort of understanding in terms that Satan has this capability, this kind of avatar symbiotic relationship to help to get some being over the edge in terms of rebellion and the evil deed that they're plotting to do and wanting to do in the time of Jesus, where Jesus is going to be betrayed by Judas, and Satan actually enters into Judas and does the same thing. So I think we can use that as how Satan has this influence. And remember, he's not the one punished. And he seems to have either been demoted at this point at a time to a Satan status, which is an adversary status, at this point in time or sometime before, but likely before, because it would almost suggest that if it was at the Eden point in time, that there's an argument here you could make as who rebelled first, the Nakash or Satan. And I think it was Satan that rebelled first, had influence over the Nakash, and seduced him into rebelling. So I think the rebellion happens before that. When's open to speculation, but I think it fits a little bit better before the Eden account. And so when we're looking at all of this now and the fall of Eden, this all of a sudden puts us in complete context with what's going on with the greater sort of story of the Bible, that when did the rebellion actually happen, and what is the overall meaning and the connection to the fall in Eden and humankind's destiny as it is linked in this story to the fallen angels and the angelic rebellion. And it's my belief that this is what the whole Bible is talking about from the human aspect, is how the angelic rebellion is completely interconnected with humankind's destiny as it plays out before the angelic realm. And as we look at who this ancient Satan was who led this angelic rebellion, let's now look at what Satan was described as, and adding on to episode 11. So if you haven't watched episode 11, I suggest you go back, because it's got some very, very important details that we covered off there about Satan. And in Ezekiel 28 again, which is the cherubim account of Satan, we're told that Satan was created perfect. But he was also created with free choice, and he was also created immortal. Whereas humankind is not created immortal. They did have access to the tree of life in Eden, but not self-sustaining immortality. And the fall of Eden produced a result where we don't have access to that. And so we were created mortal and with male and female so that we can procreate, because we were mortal. And again, all of that is implied in the Eden account in Genesis 2. And so when we look at Satan being created perfect and through free choice, we also know he was one of the greatest individuals ever created by God, just as we talked about in episode 11, and we're going to add another level to that as we go here, but also understand that he was corrupted by his great wisdom, his great beauty, and the splendor that he portrayed. And again, it's just some significant descriptions of who Satan was before his fall. And that we talked about in episode 11 that he was also seraphim. And Again, in Ezekiel 28, we have a cherubim who is walking amongst the fiery stones, and that's where the seraphim are, and who are ministers or priests before God, just as they're depicted as six-winged angels in Isaiah 6, working in the fiery stones before the altar of God. And one of the angels takes the stones to the lips of Isaiah to purify his sin, as what a minister or priest would do. And so when we look at a cherubim, they were the ones who fanned and covered the throne area. They weren't in the fiery stones, except that in this case, we have Satan, who actually does the same as a seraphim. And of course, this matches up very, very well with the term fiery serpent angel, which is the definition for seraphim, which again, I think matches up very, very well with the description in Revelation 12, where he's called a serpent and a dragon, so in his seraphic form or his serpent form. And he also has another title called the Red Dragon. And the Red Dragon is, again, a dragon would be a serpent with wings, in this case, an angelic serpent with wings, which is a seraphim angel. And again, they were fiery serpent angels, and they had the faces of a serpent, as the understanding goes here. And red dragon, the word red is another underscoring of this definition, because red goes back to G 4450 and 4452, meaning fire or the color of fire or fire like. So he is the fiery red dragon, a seraphim angel, as they're understood in Isaiah 6. And so we get a fuller understanding as to his seraphic form and as an archangel, as what we talked about in episode 11. And we're also told in Ezekiel 28:13, which is loaded with details, he had 9 stones to adorn him. And most people just say, okay, that's decorative. These stones that decorate him, decorated Satan, is deeper than just the decoration aspect. The other area in the Bible where we might get a reference to that would be with the 12 stones on the vests of the Levite priests. And again, note the priest aspect, just as seraphim were the ministers in the altar. But Satan only had 9. So this is, to me, is suggesting that there's a resolution going on here that needs to succeed the Levite order of Israel, created through the Holy Covenant for a short period of time, the time of the Gentiles and the time of Israel until the end time, that this is going to be replaced. And so this is indicating another sort of signal that Satan was more than an archon, more than a seraphim, and more than a cherubim. He was actually a high priest serving before God's altar and before he fell. And so after his fall, this high priest is eliminated. And he's eliminated to become the adversary and to be degraded to Satan's status as an adversary. And in John 8, we understand in verse 44 that Satan becomes the father of lies now, the adversary of God, the adversary of humans. And everything he does is a lie, because that's his natural language and it's designed to lead humankind astray and to ensure humankind doesn't fulfill their destiny. And he's also called a murderer from the beginning, which is a very, very important understanding here, because as we look at the meaning of beginning, that goes back to, again, a series of words that are all interconnected here that we've been talking about in today's show in episode 11. Beginning goes back to G746 and G56, meaning arc and or archon. And it also means beginning or chief ruler. So when it talks about a father of lies and a murderer from the beginning, from the true chief ruler from the beginning to the time of Eden and before, as it has all of these additional meanings, and he's a murderer from the beginning because by convincing Nakash to cause the fall of Adam and Eve by eating of the tree of good and evil so they can be like gods, it is designed to separate humankind and Adamites from the tree of life and to bring upon this mortality, which outside of Eden, after they're banned, Adam and Eve are banned from Eden, their life is going to come to an end. A long life, but death nonetheless. And this is why he is called the murderer from the beginnings. And this is Satan's revenge. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But I want to underline that we know this is Satan in John 8 that's being talked about, because it is caused by the devil. And the devil is used, and that's Diabolos, which is also used as devil in Revelation 12, where we have the dragon and the seraphim and the red dragon definitions to who Satan is and the one who leads the whole world astray right from the beginning. So you need to tie all of that together to get a full understanding of the influence Satan had. And he was there from before, and our destiny is uniquely tied to the destiny, or the fate, as it will turn out to be, of the rebellious angels led by Satan, who are going to go to the lake of fire. And I look at Eden, and I call it in my book, Satan's First Revenge. And it is followed by other revenges that Satan is going to administer and work as the puppeteer through his rebellious co-conspirator angels and the Nephilim and the demon spirits that descend from the Nephilim to bring more revenges on humankind. And I believe this is first reflected in the second revenge as a prophecy fulfillment of Genesis 3:15 with the serpent seed, as I understand and reading the Bible literally. And this is fulfilled in Genesis 6 with the sons of God, the rebellious angels led by Satan, who create the Nephilim, the giants of Genesis 6 that causes the flood. And of course, the flood is part of the revenge, because the flood is designed to destroy humanity, except that God, and everything they do before that is designed to destroy humanity. But God saves eight to give a restart, to fulfill the age of the Gentiles, because he is greater than free choice. He is greater than what Satan and the fallen angels are trying to do here. And so I would even look at when Jesus comes along and Satan is trying to tempt Jesus in the desert to follow him, and then is tempting people and pulling the strings of people to ensure that Jesus is going to be crucified. These are also part of the revenges to ensure that humankind doesn't fulfill their destiny. And I'm going to talk about that destiny in a second, but I want to go to why I say they didn't understand the Alpha Omega aspect of God and the hidden knowledge that he has that he doesn't reveal to all beings until the right time. And this is also going to include the mystery of God that's revealed in the end time revelations. A little bit different, but along the same similar sort of lines. And in 1 Corinthians 2:7-9, it talks about if Satan and or the princes, which are the archons, G758 again, you need to get fuller understanding by taking these words back to Greek. I would very much encourage that. They are the princes or the fallen angels. If they had known about the resurrection and the resurrection plan, they wouldn't have crucified Jesus. But they didn't know about this hidden knowledge. And this whole understanding of the resurrection is part of the Melchizedek resolution that I'm going to get to in a minute or two here. But understand that this is part of the plan to raise humankind above angels. That's talked about in 1 Corinthians 6:3. And to judge the angels, and to judge them, you have to be raised higher than them to judge them. Or they have to be lowered, but it clearly says that we're going to judge the angels, and I'm going to connect that to being higher than angels in a minute or two here. And so this is the Satan's revenge, and how God saves us is through the Melchizedek resolution. And what's interesting about this is it really gets us into a lot of other different kinds of prophecy, but we should know that and understand that God is Alpha Omega, so none of this is unexpected for God, and he is going to overcome free choice because he's greater than free choice, and it's all going to be resolved by the end time. So how do we know that we're going to be raised higher than angels? Well, in Hebrews, it talks about it's done through the resurrection process that the angels did not anticipate. And in this process, we're adopted in Hebrews by Jesus to be his brothers and sisters. But in heaven, we probably don't have a gender. Certainly, there's no marriage, but I'm going to say both from a physical sense that we live in and that we understand things from today. And so we understand that this adoption process is because of the resurrection that's talked about, first of all, in Acts 2 at the time of the Pentecost. And it's also talked about in Hebrews 12. Even though we don't have human fathers, we're going to be raised up like sons of God and we're going to be adopted. And you can also check Hebrews 2. 1, Galatians 4, 5 through 7, John 1, 12, and Philippians 2, 14 to get a better understanding of this adoption process as it works through the resurrection process that leads us to the Melchizedek resolution. And so we're going to be adopted as part of the resurrection process, and the resurrection process of Jesus puts him in a position to become the high priest and replace Satan, who was eliminated as high priest in prehistory. And so when we look at this as being told from before was done, we look to Psalms. So this is part of the prophecy, is what I'm trying to say here. In Psalms 110, we get a prophecy for the Messiah who becomes Jesus, who will come back in the end time and will be the ruler. And he's also prophesied to be Melchizedek, the high priest in the end time, that he is the ruler over all of the kingdoms as we go into the millennium. So we know this is an end time prophecy. And Melchizedek, we're introduced in prehistory again after the flood in Genesis 4, which to me is Genesis 14, to me, which is no coincidence, is about the War of Giants. And again, if you want to understand the War of Giants, get a hold of me. I have a nice document on Genesis 14. I'll send that to you. But this is part of the same narrative where Melchizedek is going to bless Abraham after that war, and Abraham is going to give him, a tenth of everything. And so we have this end time prophecy with Melchizedek that goes back to the time of Abraham, and Abraham is blessed by Melchizedek. And it was really important that this blessing, because Abraham is the one who is going to be the father of monotheism and the father of Israel as it comes through his progeny, that is going to produce the Messiah, that's going to have the resurrection plan put in place, where Jesus is going to become the high priest of the order of Melchizedek. And what's important about that is we understand in Genesis 14 combined with Hebrews 7 is that Melchizedek is called not only the King of Salem or the King of Jerusalem, he's also called the King of Righteousness, the King of Peace, and the Priest of the Most High. And all of these are messianic terms, especially when we overlay Psalms 110 over those titles. And what's even more interesting is that in Hebrews 7 and verse 3, we understand that Melchizedek did not have a genealogy recorded in the Old Testament. Go through the Table of Nations, go through the Old Testament from Genesis 1 right through to the end of the Old Testament. We do not get a genealogy for who Melchizedek is. Very, very interesting, and that's confirmed in the New Testament. It also says he has no father and no mother. It also said there is no death and no birth that's recorded, but he's made in the likeness of the Son of God, another messianic term. This language is not coincidence. That's because Jesus is going to become the high priest, and he's the Word of God before he is made flesh. And it's my belief with these titles that are provided and the linkage of Melchizedek with Jesus, who is the Word made flesh and who was crucified and went back to God, is that this was Jesus coming down before becoming flesh, but taking a form in the physical world to bless Abraham, who is going to be the father of the monotheism, the father for Christians, the father for the Israelites, and how the Messiah, Jesus, is later going to come through. It's just sort of perfect in that Alpha Omega understanding of who Jesus and God is. And so all of this makes sense when we start to move into what this order is designed to do. So as we move into Hebrews 5, verse 5 through 9, we get some more very, very important details about Jesus' connection to Melchizedek and actually being Melchizedek, actually before Jesus. So it's a very, very enlightening set of passages and information that gives us a greater understanding of what's going on in the Bible and what's going to happen in the future. So Jesus is, Hebrew 5, the high priest and the Son of God. And he is the one who becomes the author of salvation through the resurrection as the Word of God, who atoned for all the sins of the world as the high priest of the Melchizedek order. So he now replaces Melchizedek as Jesus, who actually, I think, is the Word of God before he becomes physical and implanted to become Jesus in the time of Mary in the New Testament. And he is made, in verse 9, perfect and made perfect also through the resurrection and his suffering. So he has additional credentials over and above just his creation as perfection, but his suffering even raises him to another level if that were possible, and seemingly it is, and as a replacement for Satan, who was also created perfect, but chose through free choice to rebel, whereas the Word, who became Jesus through free choice, agrees to the suffering, goes through the suffering, and clearly through free choice returns to God, and through free choice will become the Melchizedek high priest. And again, it's just how closely that we're connected to the angelic rebellion that just makes all of this so very, very interesting. And then in Hebrews 8:20, it goes on to say that Jesus intercedes for us and adopts humans as his brothers. And because of, and this is done to create this new order to replace a temporary mortal order that was created with the Levites, who had the 12 stones on their vests. And it is designed to replace Satan as the high priest who was removed from that in prehistory at some point in time. And because Jesus was resurrected and part human as part of the vessel and is now raised as a brother of humankind, or humankind being adopted as brothers of Jesus, it creates this eternal order where humans are adopted into because of the resurrection of Jesus. And so it now becomes the eternal high priest order that's never going to be replaced, and Jesus is never going to rebel against God. And all of this is what I call the Melchizedek resolution, that is part of the whole plan that was made before creation, that all the names of the Book of Life are allowed to play out in this epoch of Adam, so that the names not erased will be fulfilled, that all who choose God will be adopted as brothers, raised higher than angels in the future time, and will judge angels, and these angels who have done all of this these horrible things to humankind will be sent to the lake of fire. And it just underlines again how Jesus is and God are greater than free choice. Through free choice, through Angels' free choice, human free choice, all of this is being resolved, and all comes to fruition through the end time with its ultimate completion at the end of the millennium and Satan going to the lake of fire. So this concludes the broadcast today, but if you're looking for information, what I'm talking about today on Satan or the adoption process as it's as it affects our ultimate destiny, then get a hold of me through my website at thegenesis6conspiracy.com, Genesis 6, that's the number 6conspiracy.com, and on there I have an email that you can get a hold of me and ask for whatever information you're looking for by subject, and I'll send that to you on a document, or you can get a hold of me through Facebook under Gary Wayne or Twitter under Gary Wayne as well, at Gary Wayne 63, at Gary Wayne 63. So until the next time, this is the Christian Contrarian, Gary Wayne, signing off and saying, welcome to my world of not taking the status quo and continuing to dig deeper into what the Bible says so that we can spread the message and help more people to ensure their names are not erased through, erased from the book of life, as we talked about earlier. So, again, thank you.